The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at new and evolving ways of bringing important science news to the public. A little later, we're joined by science writer Jennifer Ouellette to talk about a new print collection of some of last year's best online science writing. But before we get to that, let's look at a big story about human health and food production that was reported through an exciting new model of collaborative science journalism. I'm here with science journalist Maren McKenna. She writes for Self, More, Health, and other national magazines. She's a blogger for Wired and a regular contributor to the Annals of Emergency Medicine. She's worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Boston Herald, the Cincinnati Inquirer, and the Rockford Register-Star. That's quite the list. She's also a former staff member at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, and that's at the University of Minnesota. And just an aside, her newsroom nickname is Scary Disease Girl, so you know what you're getting into, folks. Maren last appeared on the show back in episode 127 to talk about her book, Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. Welcome back to the show, Maren.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, you're here to talk about a story that you've been covering for the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and this is potentially a huge deal, both from the public health perspective and in terms of food production as well. So first off, what is the Food and Environment Reporting Network?
The Food and Environment Reporting Network, or FERN for short, is a new foundation and grant-funded attempt to fill a hole in the media. I think lots of people know by now that what we think of as the mainstream media, newspapers, some magazines, and parts of television have been kind of collapsing under the weight of the internet and changes in the way that people consume media and changes in the way that media is funded. So to fill up some of those holes, a number of journalism shops have arisen that are grant or foundation funded that attempt to enable people to do long form and investigative work and that then gets marketed or brokered to the traditional media. So FERN was started almost 2 years ago by some people who had always worked in new media and some people who were sort of refugees from mainstream media to do just this, to identify stories about food, agriculture, health, and the environment that were no longer being told by the mainstream media. FERN actually funds people or finds funding for people to do investigative journalism and then brokers the resulting journalism to the mainstream media. In the case of this particular investigation, to both the magazine The Atlantic on its website and to ABC News.
So let's get the short version of the story here, and then we'll sort of break it down. What's the connection between chickens and urinary tract infections in humans?
The connection is that as they grow, chickens, almost all chickens raised in the world, so the vast majority, they're fed antibiotics because that is sort of a basic condition of intensive livestock raising. Those antibiotics are creating antibiotic-resistant organisms in the chicken guts that get onto the chicken's meat when they're slaughtered. Those bacteria cross to humans and are believed to be causing really high rates of antibiotic-resistant infections, particularly bladder infections, that in some cases can cross into the bloodstream and cause really serious and sometimes life-threatening infections.
That was the most succinct thing I think I've ever heard. Thank you. Well done. Now, that's basically the finished puzzle. So let's get into the backstory on all the pieces. Let's start with urinary tract infections. And I will try not to be too disturbed by this. So in case there's anyone listening who's lucky enough to have never had one, what is a UTI?
A UTI is an infection, usually from bacteria, of the lower urinary system, the bladder and the tube that connects the bladder to the outside of the body, which is called the urethra. And, you know, anyone who's had this, and it's overwhelmingly women who have them just because of a because of our anatomy. Women are more vulnerable to it than men. Anyone who's had one will remember it and probably never wants to have one again. You know, the infections irritate the lining of the bladder. They make you want to pee much more. When they get really intense, if they're not treated or if you don't pay attention to it, you not only want to pee more, but you may be producing blood and pus, and it's very painful, and you want to stay home from work and you can't concentrate on anything. UTIs are not good, and they are really common. 6 to 8 million UTIs a year just in the United States.
And it's usually caused by E. coli, correct?
That's right. And that's the anatomy issue that I mentioned. E. coli is a bacterium that lives in the guts of every warm-blooded thing and some cold-blooded things as well, like lizards and fish. It's just incredibly common, intestinal resident. And a lot of E. coli is a very wide grouping of bacteria. Some of them just reside harmlessly in the gut and never want to go anywhere else. But there's another sort of subgrouping of E. coli that tend to want to get out of the gut. And when they do, can cause disease in other parts of the body. In the case of UTIs, what happens is that E. coli get from the end of the gut to the beginning of the urinary system, which is much easier in women because it's just physically a shorter distance than it is in men. And then the E. coli climb up the urethra and up into the bladder and start a UTI.
And we should be clear that a UTI isn't just inconvenient. It's potentially life-threatening, right?
That's right. At the very least, UTIs are something that make you miserable. Don't think I've ever known a woman who didn't think that a UTI was at least temporarily a big deal. They often are costly in terms not only of having to go to the doctor and get antibiotics, but they're also costly in lost work time and lost work productivity because they happen so often that people just spend a lot of time going to the doctor for them. And in their most serious manifestations, they are costly not just in terms of productivity, but they're potentially costly in terms of life. Because when one of these UTIs gets elsewhere in the body beyond the bladder, they can cause all kinds of infections. And the reason for that is because going north from the bladder, there's another set of tubes. They're called the ureters, and they connect to the kidneys. The kidneys exist to filter stuff out of the blood and then send it out of the body via the urinary tract system. That means that in the kidneys, there's a lot of places for things to cross backward into the blood. When this E. coli causing this UTI does that, first it can cause a kidney infection, which is unpleasant by itself and extremely painful. But if the E. coli actually gets out of the kidneys and back into the bloodstream, it causes a bloodstream infection, what people think of as blood poisoning. The technical term would be septicemia or bacteremia, and that can be life-threatening.
And doctors are reporting both an increase in UTIs and an increase in UTIs that are drug-resistant?
That's right. And this really has been something that physicians have been talking about among themselves for a couple of years now. It's important to say that there's no national count of when UTIs happen. There are certain diseases in the sort of public health system that when you get them or when your doctor recognizes a disease in you, your doctor has to tell someone. Usually they tell the local or the state public health department, and then the state public health department tells the national public health authorities, who are the Centers for Disease Control. But that's called a reportable disease, and UTI is not a reportable disease. As a result, we don't really know in a hard numbers sense exactly how many there are, but there are really solid estimates that they are in the millions. And when you talk to people who take care of patients with UTIs, every one of them I've spoken to has said, oh yeah, I see a lot of those, and I'm seeing more of them. And people increasingly have been saying they are seeing ones that are antibiotic resistant. In fact, The report, informal and sort of not counted, but just sort of talking reports of antibiotic resistance have become so common that the Professional Society for Physicians Who Treat Infectious Diseases, which is called the Infectious Diseases Society of America, actually last year revised the sort of national guidelines that physicians are supposed to pay attention to when they treat various diseases. And for UTIs, they basically said antibiotic resistance is growing in UTIs, and it's growing to such a degree, and it's becoming somewhat unpredictable, so that we're not exactly sure what to recommend. We cannot make a blanket recommendation for the entire country for every UTI. There's additional workups that you have to do.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with science writer Maren McKenna. We're discussing her new report on the connection between industrial poultry production and bacterial infections in humans. Some more background. Let's talk about the bacteria itself. So broadly, and I mean very broadly, how do antibiotics work?
Antibiotics work by killing bacteria. The way antibiotics started back in 1928 is that Alexander Fleming, whom we think of as sort of the father of antibiotics, was kind of sloppy in his lab work. He was working in London. He was studying staph. He left a window open in his laboratory. It was London. It was warm. Probably didn't have air conditioning in 1928. And something blew in across his culture plates. When he came back to check them 2 weeks later, because he needed to reuse the culture plates, he discovered that one of the culture plates of staph, which should have been just edge-to-edge bacteria, kind of like a lawn, instead was polka dot, because something that had blown in through the window had landed on the plate and killed the bacteria wherever it had landed. And what turned out to be in the center of those polka dots were specks of the mold penicillium, from which we refined the compound penicillin. And all antibiotics have been based on that sort of paradigm ever since. They were initially the actual compounds that some organisms made in order to kill other organisms, or they are laboratory copies and then laboratory refinements of compounds that initially were natural. So antibiotics have a variety of ways of killing organisms, disease organisms. Sometimes they interfere with the wall of the bacterium. Sometimes they get through the wall and mess around with the inside of the bacterium. But the point is they kill them. But bacteria have been responding to these kind of compounds since long before we came along and took them into the laboratory. And what they evolved in response to that threat from other bacteria were various kinds of defenses. Now that those defenses are in response to our antibiotics, we call those defenses antibiotic resistance.
Now, this isn't just a problem with the bacteria that cause UTIs, right? This is a problem with bacteria in total.
Absolutely. And antibiotic resistance, you know, first emerged not long after penicillin was identified, or to be more precise, not long after penicillin actually started to be used, which was in the early 1940s. Every time we do something in the lab to produce a compound that kills bacteria, the bacteria respond in a kind of game of leapfrog, or sometimes I hear it described as whack-a-mole, the carnival game. It's gotten to the point now where for some diseases, some disease organisms, there are only one or two antibiotics that work. And there's a lot of stuff in that observation, some of which is that some newer antibiotics actually haven't been very innovative and they just kind of copied other antibiotics. There's also that because antibiotic resistance moves so rapidly, pharma companies have gotten kind of tired of making antibiotics because they don't make much money off them anymore, not compared to things like insulin and statins and Viagra. But the reality is the World Health Organization, along with many, many other medical and public health authorities, really consider antibiotic resistance a global emergency. We really are on the verge of running out of drugs.
Oh, doom. Okay. So the sort of the last piece of this puzzle, before we get to the connection between chickens and humans, we should look at the farming practices that are possibly to blame here. So can you just describe generally the way that chickens are raised in an industrial setting?
So if you think of if any of us think of chicken in a farm context, what we have in our heads is sort of an image of chickens out in some nice green space, some farm pasture, scratching around and, you know, pecking up bugs and sitting on their little nests and so forth. And that may be the setting in which chickens evolved to live, but it is not the setting in which chickens, for the most part, now live in food production. Most meat chickens in food production, which are also generally called broilers to distinguish them from layers, which are the chickens that produce eggs. Most broilers are raised in very large sheds that hold thousands of birds at a time. They barely move around. They live very short lives, on the order of weeks. And that, those living conditions are so different from what chickens actually evolved to live in, that we routinely give them antibiotics to essentially protect them against the conditions in which they're raised. If chickens in very close confinement weren't routinely given antibiotics to protect them against disease threats, they might not survive. Antibiotics are one of the fundamental underpinnings of modern intensive agriculture.
So would it be possible to meet that demand without industrialized farming?
That is a question that is much disputed at the moment. And there's there are sides firing reports back and forth at each other. On the one hand, you'll hear people say, you know, the only way we're going to feed the world, the coming world of 9 billion people that is supposed to be here by the year 2050, the only way is to have intensive agriculture. There are people who very much disagree with that, including the special rapporteur for agriculture for the United Nations, who wrote a report, I think it was last year now, who said, no, actually, this is not the way to go, that that we need a variety of different sizes, a variety of farming enterprises that are of different sizes and intensivity. I guess that's probably not a word, but that solely intensive agriculture is, we do it because we're doing it, but it's not the only thing we could do.
Okay, now, what role do antibiotics play in this process?
So antibiotics are the thing that kind of stitches together all of these different observations. There's chickens being raised in very close confinement. There's a rising demand for protein. Chicken is the protein that we eat the most in the United States. And then there are these rising rates of antibiotic resistance in a particular infection that has a link to the gut. What links all those together is we give the chickens antibiotics as they're being raised. All bacteria are not equally vulnerable to antibiotics. So especially when you give the smaller doses that are the sort of prophylactic of prophylactic use in agriculture, in the chickens' guts, some bacteria die, but some survive. And they survive because they're resistant, because they have some protection that they've evolved against these antibiotics. Then the chickens are killed, and the bacteria that are remaining in their guts get out of the gut when the chicken is essentially disassembled at slaughter. Slaughter is a kind of messy process. Now, things are supposed to be rinsed off and cleaned and so forth, but the reality is that some gut bacteria survive on meat. We know that because there are so many outbreaks of foodborne illness across the years that have to do with bacteria that were gut bacteria in an animal originally, not just E. coli, but Salmonella and Shigella and Campylobacter and so forth. Someone buys that chicken. They perhaps don't cook it as fully as they might. And the surviving resistant bacteria go from the meat into the person's gut. Then, at a certain point, somehow those bacteria get out of the gut. And any woman who's ever had a UTI, you know, I'm sure has heard the things that we're told that to do that are supposed to make it less likely for you to get a UTI. Suffice it to say, some of the contents of the gut somehow get toward the urethra and the bladder.
That was the most diplomatic way of putting that. Thank you.
Thank you. So the E. coli, you know, essentially cross our skin. They get up the urethra, they get up into the bladder, and then you have what under normal circumstances would be just a UTI, which would be unpleasant enough. But because the E. coli that was in your gut, that came from the chicken, that was given antibiotics, turns out to be a resistant E. coli, what you have instead is a resistant urinary tract infection. And the thing that's sort of the final step in all of this is that urinary tract infections, UTIs, are so common as I said, millions of them a year just in the United States. And they're so distinctive. There aren't many other things that feel like a UTI, so that when you describe the symptoms, everybody pretty much knows what you're talking about, including your doctor. So overwhelmingly, when people go to the doctor, they don't usually get a test to determine what's causing their UTI. They're usually first diagnosed empirically, that is to say, on the basis of their symptoms.
Right.
The physician gives the standard antibiotics for a UTI. Unfortunately, if the E. coli is resistant to those standard antibiotics, then it is as if the infection hasn't been treated at all, because it's been treated by something with something for by which let me try that again. It's been treated with something that the E. coli no longer responds to. So it's effectively an untreated infection. And an untreated infection can keep spreading, including spreading up the kidneys and into the bloodstream, and then getting really bad.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with science writer Maren McKenna. She's been reporting on evidence of a connection between antibiotics used in poultry production and drug-resistant bacteria showing up in human patients. And we'll be right back to talk more about that after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with science journalist Maren McKenna. She's a blogger for Wired, and she's the author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. Before the break, we were talking about a new investigation from the Food and Environment Reporting Network that shows a possible link between the use of antibiotics in raising chickens and an increase in resistant infections in humans. Yay. So now that we've sort of looked at all that background, let's tie them together. Where is the evidence, ma'am, that there's a connection between antibiotics in chicken and drug-resistant urinary tract infections in humans?
The evidence is surprisingly solid. It's been coming out over almost a decade from researchers in several different countries around the world. And I happened to notice this, actually, because antibiotics and antibiotic resistance, as you mentioned, are the thing that I write about the most. Started seeing these papers that would be from someone in Minnesota, someone in New York, someone in Spain, someone in Jamaica, and together they added up to a pretty solid case. What these different researchers have done, mostly working independently, though I'm sure they talk to each other, is they have looked for this antibiotic resistance at various steps along that chain that we were just talking about, from the farm to the meat to the person. And what they find is that things match up, sometimes at a molecular level. So as an example, there's one set of researchers has gone to actually to supermarkets, and they've bought chicken and other meat products just kind of to test their hypothesis. And they've looked for E. coli. And then they've looked for the resistance signatures in E. coli. And then they've looked for what antibiotics are commonly used in agriculture in their countries, and do they match. Other researchers have gone to the next step, and they've bought chicken in various areas, and they've looked for resistant bacteria. And then they've actually gone to people, to women, and they've checked women for UTIs. And when the UTIs were resistant, they have analyzed the same bacteria, and they've found identical or very close matches. Now, that being said, Oh, and I should say there are some other studies as well that also look more broadly. So there are some studies that look at, say, collections of data from healthcare systems and look at the reports, the records of drug-resistant E. coli, urinary tract infections. These are in hospital patients. They come from healthcare systems where they have really good electronic health records. And again, the things match up. The resistance patterns match up. The bacteria match up. The antibiotics that would have been used match up. Now, so is this evidence perfect? No, it's not. The flaw in this argument is the flaw that is in the arguments for any impact of antibiotic resistance on humans, and this is what it is. There's not really any way, under our understanding of medical ethics, that anyone could devise and carry out the experiment that would utterly prove, with no debate allowed, that antibiotic resistance moves from the farm. Because here's what you'd have to do. You'd have to take an animal. You'd have to feed them antibiotics. You would have to slaughter the animal, check their gut to be sure antibiotic resistant bacteria were present, make sure that antibiotic resistant bacteria were on the meat that that animal became, feed that particular animal to a particular human, and then check to see whether the human developed an infection. We don't, in our modern understanding of experimental ethics, allow people to be deliberately infected with things.
Right.
We haven't done the Nuremberg trials. So when you can't do that, from a single animal to a single human, what you rely on instead is evidence across populations, populations of chicken, populations of people, broadly speaking, epidemiological evidence. And the epidemiological case for this is strong.
Okay, so you say it's strong. So how sure are people, sort of across a broad consensus, how sure are people that they have found a connection here?
You know, the researchers are sure. And when you talk to people who work in antibiotic resistance elsewhere, but don't necessarily work on looking at agricultural causes, they find it persuasive. The people who don't find it persuasive are people who are on the agricultural side. And that, you know, that was very clear, but when we did the initial investigation that ran on ABC News and in The Atlantic, you know, I was sure to talk to people who did not agree with this evidence, and their views are in the various pieces. But actually, after all of our stuff was published in July, the National Chicken Council actually put out a statement in which they said, we don't agree, which is the same thing that researchers had said in the piece that has the most text in it, that the longest piece effectively is the piece that was at The Atlantic. They said, you know, we think it's possible that antibiotic resistance may emerge on farms, but we don't agree that it necessarily crosses off farms. And most importantly, we think that when you consider all the possible sources of antibiotic resistant illness in humans, we just don't think the risk from agriculture is that high.
Well, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with science writer Maren McKenna. We're discussing her new report on the connection between industrial poultry production and bacterial infections in humans. So this is all potentially a very big deal. So what do we do about it? I assume that being really, really careful about handling and preparing chicken isn't quite enough, but it's still a good idea.
It's definitely a good idea. You know, it's important to say that consumers play a role in this. Just as consumers play a role in protecting themselves against E. coli 0157 in hamburger, against, salmonella traveling on sprouts. I hope I'm remembering that correctly, that it's salmonella on sprouts. It might be another organism. Food safety sort of ends in the kitchen. The problem I have with that assertion, though, is that I myself feel, as someone who has had foodborne illnesses, in addition to somebody who writes about foodborne illnesses, that we can't ask consumers to be the only ones responsible if they are dealing with a system that is, you know, just not responsive to them.
Right.
And I think we can see that the system is not responsive to them and is not taking adequate care of them by just the enormous number of foodborne outbreaks that we have in the United States every year. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's you know, it's hundreds of thousands of people that I may have that wrong by an order of magnitude. It may be in the millions, that are made sick every year by foodborne illness. If consumers' behavior was perfect, or if, you know, then maybe we would have fewer of those. But I'm reluctant to blame people unless we can also turn some of the responsibility back to food production. And the big question there is, if the question is, what could we do in food production that would help to ameliorate this problem so that the deck is not so stacked against consumers? That the answer is, we could do something to rein in antibiotic use in agriculture. And if we're not willing to do that, which is a really open question, then the least we could do is keep better track of it. We don't, in this country, have a good count even of how much antibiotics or which antibiotics we're using in agriculture. And we have pretty much zero surveillance for what's coming out the other end of agriculture, for what kind of antibiotic resistant organisms are emerging. If we did those, we'd at least have a better sense of what sort of risks people are taking. And if we reduced antibiotic use or changed how they're used, then we might have a lower occurrence of antibiotic resistant bacteria as well.
Has there been any interest from government in terms of regulation about antibiotic use in industry?
Yeah, this is an interesting story, actually, because, you know, when it comes to things like regulating big agriculture, you kind of expect the government to be the bad guy. But it turns out that the Food and Drug Administration has actually been trying to do something about this for decades, literally for decades. The first big assertion that the use of antibiotics in agriculture might be having a negative effect on human health dates back to 1969. It was a report by a body formed by the British government. It's known as the Swan Report. Now, 1969 sounds like a long time ago, but remember, the antibiotic era only starts in about 1943, maybe 1937 or so, if you count back to sulfa drugs. But the early 1940s is when penicillin comes on the market. And penicillin is the drug that's first used in a really big way in agriculture, followed by tetracycline. So 1969, the British government says, you know, we are seeing increased amounts of antibiotic resistance as a result of agriculture. We're disturbed about it. 1972, the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, impanels a special report. And their special report says essentially the same thing. This is a problem. It really needs to be attended to more. Such that in 1977, the FDA proposes to withdraw its approvals. Remember that they're the body that approves allowing drugs onto the market. It proposes to withdraw its approval for penicillin and tetracycline to be used in agriculture, not to treat sick animals, but to be used in animals that are not sick.
Right.
Which growth promoters, the things that make the antibiotics that make animals fat, and prophylaxis, the antibiotics that protect them against potential disease threats. So the FDA files what's called a notice of a hearing, saying it's going to have hearings to discuss withdrawing these approvals. And various parts of Congress come down on it just like a ton of something. First the House, and then the Senate committees, various committees, mostly the agriculture committees, come to the FDA and say, you know, we really think you haven't done enough research. Why don't you go do a report? So the FDA does a report and says, yep, look, we still think this is a good idea. And then the Senate came back and said, well, perhaps another report. And the FDA, to them credit, came back and said, we still think this is a good idea. And this tug of war went on for decades. In fact, it was only after the Obama administration came in that the FDA started indicating that they were going to up the ante in this long stalemate, and they actually wanted to do something. So it was kind of a surprise to people when almost a year ago now, the FDA said they were actually going to give up on this long stalemate. They were going to withdraw that notice of intent for a hearing that they had filed back in 1977 and take off the books their opposition to the use of tetracycline and penicillin in this manner. They said that what they intended to do was they were going to pursue voluntary compliance by industry on reduction of antibiotic use. Now, when you talk to people in industry, they kind of roll their eyes at that and say, look, they may say it's voluntary, but we know perfectly well that if we don't do this, then things are not going to go well for us. Whether, in fact, that's true, I don't think we know. There's a wide array of opinions on that. But the fact remains, this is not the fact that antibiotic resistance emerging from the farm appears to have an impact on human health is not a new discovery. It's something that people and regulatory bodies have been struggling with now for more than 30 years.
We have some questions. This is from Squidocto.
Is antibiotic use a similar problem in other animal farming practices, such as cattle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. It certainly isn't unique to poultry. And in fact, there are particular antibiotic resistant organisms that can be pinned to particular drug uses in pigs, including my favorite organism, MRSA, which is the subject of my book, Superbug. There's an entire sort of mini epidemic of MRSA, now known as livestock-associated MRSA, that emerged in intensive pig farming as a result of the use of tetracycline. It's emerged in 2004 and has moved around the world. But the reason why this particular story is poultry. Why we at Fern got interested in poultry and thought the evidence was so interesting and persuasive is because poultry is so common. I mean, poultry really is the meat that we eat in the United States more than anything else. Didn't used to be that way. You know, back in our grandparents' or great-grandparents' time, a chicken was kind of something unusual. It was something that was like the big Sunday dish. Now it's chicken nuggets twice a day.
Twice a day.
Well,
I'm worried. There's another question from the chat. It's from David Kroll.
You wrote late last year that the European Union was banning the use of antibiotics and other growth-promoting agents in livestock. So it can be done, and I'm happy to pay extra for antibiotic-free chicken. But is there another reason to use antibiotics in preventing diseases costly to the livestock producer?
You know, no one disagrees with giving antibiotics to animals that are actually sick. To not do that would be a failure of animal welfare. And I think it would be a mistake to assume that any farmer, even a farmer operating, you know, a very large intensive chicken battery, that farmer doesn't care about animal welfare. I don't think anyone who doesn't care about animal welfare goes into farming. So, you know, when I talk to farmers, they are concerned about the health of their flocks. The question is, are we going to use antibiotics the way we use them in humans? We are really clear in human medicine, don't give antibiotics if it's an illness that doesn't respond to antibiotics or if the antibiotics are not necessary. And we have built antibiotic use that is essentially not necessary into the fundamental structure of intensive agriculture.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and Maren McKenna is causing me to make concerned faces at the mic. Maren has been reporting on evidence of a connection between antibiotics used in poultry production and drug-resistant bacteria showing up in human patients. And we're almost out of time, but before we go, I want to touch on the science journalism angle in all of this. Now, aside from your own personal interest in scary infectious organisms, what drew you to this story?
So I spent a couple of years, a few years ago, you know, writing this book about antibiotic resistance. And the book that I wrote was, as I said, was about the organism MRSA, which is surprisingly common. There are probably about 7 million MRSA infections in the United States every year. Certainly there are that many doctor and ER visits for it and thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations. But when the book was done and I wanted to sort of, you know, ignite concern nationally about MRSA, I realized that for most people, the possibility of an antibiotic-resistant infection was still pretty remote. It was important to them if it happened to them or if it happened to someone that they cared about. Mm-hmm. otherwise it just was not that high on sort of their personal radar for what they might be at risk from. In the course of reporting on MRSA, I found out about this livestock-associated MRSA that began in the Netherlands, has now spread around the world, has been found in hospitals and in people who have no connection with healthcare, has been found even here in the United States, that there's been very little study. There's been one brave research group in Iowa, which is the piggiest state in the union, who have been pursuing this for a couple of years now. But it occurred to me that the interplay between food and agriculture and antibiotics was really where that was the door into people's reasonable concern, because people might not know that many people who have antibiotic resistant infections, but everyone knows someone who eats. And if there is a risk in our food, we generally are concerned about it, in some cases possibly over concerned about it, but that's a whole separate interview. But I think people are starting to understand that there are reasonable questions to be asked, reasonable concerns to be raised about the way that we've structured agriculture, and even to use antibiotics. And even given all the economic pressures that have caused agriculture to move in that direction, that people are still willing to ask questions about whether we really should continue. And the rising rate of antibiotic resistant infections that can have some connection to food is a really good sort of pointer to how important having that conversation about the conduct of agriculture in the United States really is.
Well, and that's the thing. The thing that's really interesting is that the coverage of this story was very collaborative. You had people at the Food and Environment Reporting Network working on it, but it also got coverage from ABC and The Atlantic and on the Wired website. So why did so many outlets seem to pick up on this story all at once?
This partly shows the power of these new journalism models. I mean, don't think that there are not people writing about this issue already, because there are. There's a sort of a cadre of agriculture and food policy bloggers, Tom Laskowy, Tom Philpott, the folks at The Edibles, who have been fantastic on this issue. Mark Bittman at The New York Times is one of the standard bearers. But, you know, so X number of people read Wired, X number of people read Mother Jones, where Tom Philpott writes. But all of our audiences together don't match ABC News' audience or even Atlantic's audience. So it was the ability of this journalism collaborative brokering work that wasn't being done elsewhere because no one would pay for it anymore, that got these really big media outlets involved and really raised the profile of the issue, such that then there was all this sort of secondary coverage in other blogs, in newspapers, and places to whom this was a new issue, but something that they instantly understood was interesting for their audiences.
And that's what I find fascinating, is probably maybe 30 years ago, it would have been a TV network or a newspaper that would have been investigating this.
That's right. You know, 10 years ago when I was a newspaper reporter, it would have been, I hope, my paper investigating it. But the newspaper that I used to work for is a lot smaller than it used to be, and has much smaller ambitions as well. And that's true all across what we think of as the mainstream or traditional American media. And I feel myself, you know, really fortunate to be working with a collaborative like this that is able to invest in doing the kind of journalism that we used to trust the mainstream media to do, and brokering it back to really high-profile, big audience places where we can get the story out. Fern is not the only group doing this. There are groups trying this in all kinds of different topic areas. The sort of standard setter is ProPublica, which is also foundation-funded and does really big, intense, data-intensive investigations. But there's a whole bunch of others that are sort of topic-specific. Fortunately for me, Fern is interested in this topic, and I think the pickup of this investigation really sort of proved our model that distributing reporting like this can work.
Maren, thank you, as always, for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You'll find links to Maren McKenna and the Food and Environment Reporting Network on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. and we'll be right back with Jennifer Bolette, guest editor of the Best Science Writing Online 2012, right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at film and video as an exciting, engaging way to communicate science to the public. Guest host Marie-Claire Shanahan spends the hour with independent filmmaker and former BBC video journalist Brady Herron and artist and filmmaker Henry Reich, creator of the Minute Physics YouTube series. They'll discuss the promise and pitfalls of telling science stories in moving pictures. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'd like to talk a little more about science reporting. I'm here with Jennifer Willette, author of The Calculus Diaries and The Physics of the Buffyverse. She blogs at Cocktail Party Physics, and she's the guest editor of a new book, The Best Science Writing Online 2012. Great to have you back, Jennifer.
Oh, my pleasure.
So what is this book?
Well, it's a collection of some of the best online science writing blog posts over the course of the year, which in this case was 2011. It's been going on for a while. This is an anthology that got started in 2006 by Boris Zivkovich. He is known as the blog father for a good reason. He was one of the first to have a science blog in the earliest days when such things, you know, first came about. And he decided there was really a need to showcase some of the best stuff that was out there, because I think blogging kind of has this, or had this reputation as just a bunch of, like, unemployed people in their parents' basements sitting in pajamas and eating Cheetos all the time. And in fact, blogging has evolved into a very vital part of the mainstream media culture, I would argue. I don't think it's anywhere close to being dead, certainly not when it comes to science. And in science in particular, because so many science sections are getting killed off, this sort of thing is becoming very important. It allows scientists and science writers and graduate students to comment explicitly on what they see being played out in the national media. If they see something that a paper has come out and it's being reported on badly, say by USA Today, they can say, here's the real story. If there's a particular topic or event that happens and they want to comment on that current event and bring a sort of scientific perspective to it, now they have a voice. They can do this. Blogging is software, as Bora likes to say. It's a tool. And this tool can be used for LOL cats or YouTube videos, or it can be used to communicate science. And that's what this is all about. What's different about this edition in particular is that for the first time, I mean, all the prior editions were self-published. The posts were judged and vetted and selected on an entirely volunteer basis. This is the first time it's been published by a professional publisher and gone through a whole editing and copy editing process, and that is Scientific American Books, which is an arm of Farrar Straus. So this is kind of a big deal. I mean, this is kind of blogging, science blogging comes of age. You know, it's deemed important enough now that its annual anthology now gets a professional publisher.
Well, now, why a book format if you can already find all of this online?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's because you can get it online. The versions that are published in the anthology have been edited slightly in many cases. But also, I think that there's just something about holding a printed book in your hands. Not everybody wants to go through a whole long list of URL links and click on 18 different websites or 50 different websites to read all of these. There's just something really nice about having it all compiled into one place. And I just think people like, in the same way they like top 10 lists, they like this whole notion of here's 50 of the most, the best and most representative of science blogging that's out there. I hesitate to say these were the best blog posts of the year. They were among the best, and they certainly, I think, represent a very broad swathe of the blogosphere. Lots of different styles, lots of different voices. There's investigative reporting, there's one poem, there's humor pieces, there's Q&As, there's feature writing, there's even a bit of investigative journalism. It's just a little bit of everything. Gives you a sense of what blogs can do and how flexible they are.
Well, you definitely have a bunch of fantastic writers included. So what other names might people recognize other than yours?
Oh, well, they'll recognize Carl Zimmer, of course. He's one of the top science writers out there. They'll definitely recognize, I would hope, Deborah Blum. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner, author of the best-selling Poisoner's Handbook, which was one of my favorite books of the year when it came out. They'll probably recognize Ed Young. Brian Switek is another up-and-coming. John Rennie has been affiliated with Scientific American and other science writing for many, many years. And you've also got Maggie Kurth Baker, who edits Boing Boing, which is a very popular site. And you've also got a whole bunch of young and up-and-coming science writers. You've got some actual working scientists. Maren McKenna, who is a scary germ disease girl, as we like to call her. She's the author of a book called Superbug and blogs at Wired. And George Musser, who is a former editor at Scientific American as well. So you've got established new voices, you've got working scientists, you've got grad students, you've got science writers, and then you've just got the enthusiasts who are amateurs. And that's kind of what blogging is all about. I mean, as long as you do good work, your post can get selected.
Well, how did you choose what exactly to include? Because that seems difficult.
Yeah, there were over 700 entries. And essentially, Bora and I read every single one of them, and we farmed out chunks of like 10 or 20 to 30 or 40 judges that volunteered their time. And so every post was read by me, by Bora, and at least two other judges, and we sort of compiled that. We came to a consensus of what the top, say, 75 or 80 were. And then Bora and I had the thankless task of trying to winnow that down to 50. And there was a vetting process. And in the end, the last dozen in particular, it just came down to subjective reasons. I mean, this just hit home with me personally for some reason.
Right.
Or we wanted to get a certain diversity of topics and voices and that sort of thing. So some of these practical balance considerations also came into play.
Well, tell me about some of the pieces themselves.
Well, you know, there were some really wonderful things. There was a piece by P.Z. Myers called Dear Emma B., where he basically responds to a little girl telling her about what makes a good question and what makes a bad or lazy question, and encouraging her to ask questions at the Creation Museum, things like that. I personally loved some of the, we definitely had a lot of women voices here. Kate Clancy had a wonderful piece on what menstruation actually is, kind of debunking the old myth that women who menstruate can like wilt flowers. One of my personal favorites was How to Take the Real Measure of a Man by Allie Wilkinson. It was just hysterically funny. And the only sad thing is we couldn't get permission to run one of the photo that accompanied it. It was essentially, instead of measuring a man by the length of his male member, you measure it by the taint.
Really?
I think
fascinating.
It's the first time a science blog and anthology has talked about the taint. But you basically use a pair of calipers, and there were men who volunteered for this, and there were pictures.
So this is not dry science, is what you're saying.
No, it's not. We have pirates. We have a wonderful piece by Miriam Goldstein on her struggle to eat sustainable seafood when she really, really craves tuna and shrimp, and all these various things. How do you fight your craving for a really good shrimp sandwich against the fact that you want to eat sustainably, because she's a marine biologist. So there's a lot of these really, really wonderful pieces. There was a lot of history, some true crime. David Bresson had a wonderful piece on how geology can help you solve murders. Deborah Blum's piece was on chemistry and poisoning. So really, we had a lot of fun. There was a piece on how sperm managed to swim. It was actually on fluid dynamics by Atish Bhatia. And it's so rare to see something as obscure as fluid dynamics and some of these nonlinear phenomenon actually get covered in a very lay language friendly way. And Atish just did this wonderful job. I was so thrilled to be able to include that. And that's just all of these were wonderful. Every single one of these was a standout. That's why they're in the anthology. Those are just the ones that spring immediately to mind.
I do want to point out one, Freedom to Riot. I remember reading that piece online and it was brilliant.
Yes, Eric Michael Johnson is an anthropologist. I'm not sure if he's a grad student or postdoc. But what I loved about that piece in particular was that he managed to take a story. He had a narrative structure to it. Many of the pieces I chose had some kind of narrative element to it. And he was able to tie in his science, the anthropology, you know, this human nature, that this trend towards collective violence, and really talk about some of the studies and some of the work that's been done to talk about mob violence as it happens today and how the roots of that possibly date all the way back. And I tend to be a little leery of things like evolutionary psychology and things like this, but I felt that this was a really responsible, measured analysis of a phenomenon we often wonder about. What is it that leads to collective mob violence? Why do otherwise decent human beings, if you get them whipped into a mob frenzy, suddenly become this faceless, angry mob capable of acts that individually none of those people might be capable of? And that's a very deep human question, I think.
I am so looking forward to this.
Yeah, I want you, since you're talking about Eric, I also want to talk about Jeremy Yoder's, because this brings up another thing. Jeremy Yoder is gay. I think this is one of the first times we've had an openly gay blogger talk about his experience. He's an evolutionary biologist. And he essentially constructed his own experiment. He wanted to know, I'm a gay man, how evolutionarily am I even here? I should not the gay gene have disappeared, you know, or these, if natural selection is true. And he ended up doing his own computational experiment. So that is another real highlight, I think, of the anthology.
You're not going to give me a spoiler for that, are you?
I'm not.
Okay, so where can people pick up this marvelous book?
Well, they can pick it up at various online outlets. They can pick it up at FSG's site. It's available on Amazon. I believe it's also available. I hope it's available in bookstores. And maybe there's even an electronic version, one would think. Yeah, one would hope, given the fact that it was originally an electronic series.
And the cycle is complete.
Yes, exactly.
Well, perfect. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You can find links to Jennifer Ouellette and the Best Science Writing Online 2012 at our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, we heartily encourage you to click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, where you can keep up with show news, and of course to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. One last thing. We'd like to have the wonderfully witty PsyCurious back on the show. You may remember her from past episodes like Science is a Hell of a Drug and Semen Science, or from her blog, Neurotic Physiology. We've done episodes on her Friday Weird Science posts in the past, and we'd like to do it again. But her archives are a treasure trove of mostly dirty science-based hilarity, and so obviously we need your help to choose which posts we'd like her to talk about. Just go to scientopia.org/blogs/PsyCurious and click the category Friday Weird Science. Or you can take the easy way out and just click the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. Find your favorites and send the links to us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, and do make sure to put Friday Weird Science in the subject line so that we know you're not spam. And yes, anything, and I mean anything, that Psy has written about on a Friday is fair game. And knowing what we're working with here, we may live to regret that. Looking forward to your emails.
Await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.